Coming from the Lower Haight in San Francisco, it's the Are You Serious Show.
Are you serious?
I'm Are You Serious, and this is my show. Welcome once again to the Are You Serious Show. I'm your high and happy and ultra enthusiastic host. I got an email from somebody, I think, that said I didn't sound enthusiastic enough on the show, that the other people sounded more enthusiastic than
really?
I
did. They must have been referring to me.
You sound very... No, you're Mr. Naysayer. What's the book that you're going to write?
It's called Yeah, Right.
Right.
Comprehensive rejection of everything.
Right. Not according to any facts whatsoever.
Right.
Well, I look forward to reading that and believing everything that you have to say.
I'm very enthusiastic about it, actually.
Anyway, I'm...
enthusiastic contrarian.
I'm ripped to the tits on 1,000 mics of acid today, of course, because we are talking to a couple of drug fiends later on, or at least one drug fiend, depending on how our phone system works. And in the meantime... we're also getting ready to start doing this show, not just in audio, but also in video.
Video.
And, about a month or so, maybe even a little less than that, you'll be able to tune in every day. Is that the...
We're going to try to do some daily content.
Of course, Daily Show calls itself a daily show, and it only does Monday through Thursday.
Yeah, they do a repeat on Fridays.
All right.
I think,
so,
right?
Yeah. Who the hell knows what we can get away with and still call ourselves daily. But though, so why are we doing a video show anyway?
Why?
Some of our listeners might want to know. Just trying to
surf the zeitgeist a little bit.
The latest hype. Get in on the latest hype.
Yeah, what the kids are into.
Yeah. And maybe we can charge for subscriptions to the video.
That's a great way to get an audience. Tell them they're going to have to start paying for it.
You're all going to have to start paying for it. In fact, you probably have to buy a special device of some sort.
And you can't tinker with it.
You can't talk with it. Yeah, keep it in a lockbox and make people pay for it. I don't know. What can we do? What are we going to do with a video show that's going to be distinct and different? I guess we will be presenting visual materials, tableaus, interesting...
Yeah, sure. I mean, that's sort of...
We'll make people dress up.
Yeah.
We'll make me dress up, and I usually just look like a fucking wreck.
Yeah, now we'll make you look like an exotic wreck.
An exotic wreck, yeah. The makeup crew is already mixing it all
together. I think that, the idea, too, is to sort of take the Rocket Boom approach to, distribution and stuff like that, but actually plug in content that's different, that's a little bit meatier, a little bit more thought-oriented. I don't know. I don't mean to, disparage Rocket Boom in any way, but they kind of suck.
Well, it's not a thought-oriented,
right.
Medium.
And that's fine.
It's kind of like we don't have a reality-oriented government or, whatever.
Right.
But, I don't know if we can leave this conversation with a good quip. I don't see any good quips coming up. And the problem being that Diana Brown is back in rehab.
Damn it. Yeah.
Well. Smoking spider venom.
It'll be a big, giant, multimedia fuck-all. Daily.
All right. We are here with Michael Horowitz and with Robert Forte. And Michael Horowitz is, of course, a well-known editor of books about the psychedelic culture. He runs Flashback Books, and he's Timothy Leary's archivist. And Robert Forte is the editor of two book collections, Timothy Leary, Outside Looking In, and Entheogens and the Future of Religion. And we're here mostly to talk about the event that happened just 2-3 weeks back in Basel, which was a celebration of Albert Hofmann's 100th birthday. Albert Hofmann, of course, the man who discovered the properties of lysergic acid, LSD. And it was a great gathering of psychedelic culture as it currently exists in the year 2006. And so anyway, Michael, give us your impressions of what was going on there in Basel.
Sure. Well, I've been to just about every psychedelic conference over the last 20 years, and I consider this one to be the Woodstock of psychedelic conferences. In terms of the size, 2,000 people came. It's way larger than any previous conference. It lasted for 3 days. Went on from the early morning to the late evening. It was at a very impressive venue, the convention center in Basel. And the focus was on Albert Hofmann, who was being honored by the country, by his country, and all the, you know, scientific community, but mostly by the people who came to the conference. This is, by the way, one of the most documented of any psychedelic conference. And if people want to, like, see pictures and read reports, they should go to erowid.org, and click on LSD Symposium. And then they should also go to info.lsd.com. That's the official... I'll have to check that. That's the official website for the conference. Well, just about every aspect of LSD was covered by 75 presenters from different countries. There was so much love and energy directed towards Dr. Hofmann that he, by the closing ceremony, he was like, he just couldn't, he was exulting with it. He was on his feet. His mind is incredibly agile for somebody of his age. But he does have artificial knees and needs to walk with two canes. But at the closing ceremony, there was so much applause and love and affection poured on him that he got to his feet without his canes, and he raised his arms in the air like a rock star, I thought. I was sitting behind him. Mm-hmm. And it was a beautiful thing to see, because he was getting only the counterculture really, like, appreciates him. The scientific world doesn't care that much. He could have been, you know, a Nobel Prize winner many times over. I had the, you know, the importance of LSD. But he got all of his attention. It was great to see. I gave a talk, and I'm just going to read a little bit of the opening of that. It was to the entire assembly. And the theme of my talk was, and beginning with the famous Huxley book, From the Doors of Perception to Perception Management, or How the Rejection of Entheogens is Ruining the 21st Century. And it starts with, this is how I started out, LSD, the antidote to everything. Defined antidote as a remedy to relieve, prevent, or counteract the effects of poison. LSD is the antidote to stupidity, intelligence, past imprints, formal education, average sex, failing to get the joke. LSD is the antidote to life's problems, death's dominion, organized religion, disorganized religion, reliance on antidepressants, imperfect psychoactive drugs, less than instant gratification. LSD is the antidote to time, space, boredom, belief systems, profit and loss, the God trip. LSD is the antidote to identity, symbols, verbal expression, LSD conferences. LSD is the antidote to intolerance of the bizarre, contraindication, the sound of both hands clapping, not having psychic powers, truth and consequences. LSD is the antidote to itself. You can say anything about LSD just as LSD can say anything about you. And then I gave a line from Stephen Wright. When God takes LSD, does he see people?
That sounds. I bet you got a thunderous response to that.
Yeah, actually, it went over pretty well.
I've been looking for the antidote to everything, and I guess I have found LSD to be the antidote to everything at different
times. You know,
I
encourage people to add to that list, by the way.
What do we need to add? And Robert, why don't you give us some of your impressions?
Well, sure. I wanted to just add a couple things. First of all, Michael, if you remember back in 1977, the first time that Albert Hofmann came to this country, a group in Santa Cruz very quickly threw together a meeting, and there were thousands of people that descended upon the University of California, Santa Cruz, making
that was a big conference.
That was a big one, and it was it was in the days before psychedelic conferences became kind of a cottage industry, and with very little organization, Albert Hofmann drew. I think there were 3,000 people that came to that campus. Yeah,
I don't remember that many, but I'd love to think you're right, Robert.
Yeah, no, it's 19.
I'll go with that.
That's not the one that Peter Stafford and I organized. That was in 1981, but in 77.
No, I was that the one you're talking about.
Yeah, Tim Leary and Ginsberg and Ram Dass and all kinds of people. It was the first time they'd been together in several years, and it was just remarkable. And then we did the one in 1981, also just hippies. No, there was no money changed hands. Hundreds of people came then. And that was my beginning in the field, just to show the marvelous enthusiasm that people had for this subject. All kinds of people. And this is something that I noticed about the conference in Basel, too. You know, it was really four conferences. It was first that very proper Swiss ceremony honoring Albert that was all in German, a parade of speakers, philosophers, statesmen, scientists, representatives from Sandoz, all praising Albert, really from their hearts, you know. And here's where you saw really the difference in the Europeans from the Americans. They didn't waste any time really congratulating and recognizing the incredible contribution that this man, for a moment, all
and
of
you're
the...
You're talking about a sort of official Swiss society?
Yes, in the Museum of Culture. It was so beautiful to walk the narrow streets of Basel with Alexander Shulgin and Nick Sand to this Museum of Culture in Switzerland, jam-packed with people of all walks of life. You know, LSD excites, you know, the whole spectrum of humanity, from scientists to the most kind of flipped-out transcendent hippies, all, you know, absolutely glued to every word that was being said there. It was so passionate and so beautiful, I thought. And then we had a day off, and then we went to the conference hall proper. And even still, there are different factions, you know. There are the researchers, the professional researchers that want to see LSD work its way into the medical pharmacopoeia and be applied to treatment of the innumerable things that it has been found valuable for. And then there's, of course, the counterculture, who already knows how valuable LSD is and has applied it to their lives to transform society.
I'm curious, when people are speaking from the stage, do the researchers tend to dominate the conversation? It seems like the big counterculture sort of cheerleader heroes that used to draw these conferences together, Terence McKenna, Timothy Leary, have gone. Do people feel that that's missing, or does that element still come out?
I thought
from the stage.
I thought this conference was distinctive in that everybody was unified around Albert. In other conferences that I've been to, it seems that there's a kind of tension between researchers and the counterculture.
Right,
Michael?
Everyone had equal appeal and attention and energy directed toward them. And you're right, there were these different levels, but no one dominated.
Yeah.
Because of Albert, I think that was the focus and his presence.
And I couldn't think of another field, another conference where so many people, again, from so many different factions of society would be unified by something so profound as the mystical experience that LSD provides. You know, there were, you know, completely flipped out people there taking acid, walking around, you know.
That's good to hear, actually. I'm glad a few people were taking acid.
Well, I agree. And then the scene at night, you know, it was
I
quite...
I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead,
Michael.
when you mentioned mystical, Robert, I thought about Albert saying, for the first time I've ever heard him say, that LSD called to him. He said that a few times during his remarks. I never heard him use that word before, LSD called to me.
Yes, and that's another thing. Albert himself has been, you know, I've known him for a long time now, and he tends to be very chameleon-like. You know, if you're with him in the baths at Esalen, he has one line that he walks. When he's surrounded by his psychiatric or pharmaceutical colleagues, there's another. But here you saw kind of all parts of him coming out at
That's
once.
Right.
It was quite remarkable.
I think it's interesting, I mean, just the fact that he's 100 years old and he's in such remarkable shape. And then surely there's still a sector of society that assumes that everybody who's taken LSD, you know, several times over is probably, you know, a burnout shuffling down the street. And here we have, you know, this man who's just in impeccably great shape at 100 years old. And see, you know, LSD is a brain vitamin in many ways.
He used it late in his life. He was still using it. And he actually took it recreationally with friends many more times than we kind of knew at the late in the past.
Right.
I mean, some of my research showed that, and he also took it as a longevity a supplement. He's taken something called hydrogen that is a cousin of LSD, but not psychoactive.
Well,
and
I wish
his discovery.
That's one of the reasons for his longevity.
I wish this was something that had been brought out more in the press, just as Ken is saying here. You know, this guy is 100 years old, and except for, you know, bad knees, he shows no signs of slowing down. His mind is sharp.
His mind is 100% back as it used to be.
You know, funny. I hadn't seen him for about 12 years, and I went to say hello to him, and he says, "Oh, Robert, my friend, it's been a long time." He said, "You look so old."
We have to. We're going to break here for one moment and hear some music. So, those of you out in the audience, now is the time to smoke some DMT and hear the music. And we'll be back in a few minutes.
Are you serious?
Serious. All right, we're back, and in terms of themes and so forth, what were some of the standout moments at this conference? Was there a speech or a talk? I mean, other than Hoffman, that knocked everybody's socks off.
Michael, you want to go?
Well, I think we should. I think your seminar on Timothy Leary was one of many seminars, and there were others going on at the same time. But it was very well attended, and I thought it was one of the high points. You know, that Tim was not forgotten.
Well, again, that's evidence of what we were saying before. Usually, at a lot of these psychedelic conferences, Tim is such a complicated figure. He's usually regarded as kind of a pariah among the professional psychedelic research community.
Right, he ruined the research.
He ruined research.
Supposedly,
which
is a ridiculous narrative.
Yes, it is. And I'll tell you something funny. I was wandering around through his archives a couple of days before I went to the conference, and I found a clipping from a newspaper where one of the researchers had accused Tim of ruining government research, and Tim had written in the margins in his hand, he says, "I am proud to have ruined government-sponsored research."
And we shouldn't forget that Tim, as a researcher himself, gave us the concept of set and setting, which, frankly, I turns up in every paper I've ever seen by the researchers who claim that he ruined research.
Yeah, well, so I was invited to give this presentation on Tim, and just a couple of days before I left, of course, that article in the New York Times came out, which was a very positive article about Albert Hofmann turning 100 years old, but it ends with Albert Hofmann saying that the popularization of LSD and what Timothy Leary did was a crime.
I saw that. I was going to ask about that.
Yes. Well, so I get this article, and I think, oh, great. You know, first of all, it's an honor to come to this conference and talk about Tim. But now I'm put in a position of disagreeing with Albert Hofmann on his 100th birthday, because I don't think that what Tim did was a crime at all.
Right.
So the first thing I did was go to Albert and try to get some clarity on this. And that is not what Albert said.
Not surprising.
This is what and then we wrote a letter. We contacted the New York Times, and the author, Craig Smith, was very apologetic, and he said that it was a translator's error, and that they did finally issue a correction. Now, Albert has been, you know, for the whole time, kind of ambivalent about Timothy Leary, because he, of course, almost single-handedly, or was at least a major force in creating the counterculture's use of LSD, and causing the research to shut down, but it also, you know, created this community. So Albert feels two ways about it, and so it was, you know, the other thing is,
well, how did you approach it, and what was the dialogue like then?
Well, the way I did it, I started, you know, I looked at Tim's career and back in the 1950s, and what was the general attitude of social scientists toward what they saw as encroaching fascism and totalitarianism in the United States. Remember, these were the days of experiments like Solomon Asch, showing that a majority of people would defy their own senses to conform to the group opinion.
And of course, Skinner was the dominant model there, B.F. Skinner, the behaviorist.
Stanley, B.F. Skinner, the behaviorist, looking just at the external aspects of behavior. There are also the days of Stanley Milgram, who showed that people would administer nearly fatal electric shocks to their fellow students if a man in a uniform told them to.
Right.
Or Philip Zimbardo's studies at Stanford, where people would, when in a mock prison environment, people would actually subject people to degrading acts of cruelty and torture because people told them to. So social scientists saw that there was something gravely wrong with American society. And Tim and Frank Baron were two of many that devoted their careers to awakening consciousness, to saving democracy. And you know, this is not very well known, but one of Tim's first research projects was to show, this is before LSD or mushrooms, that psychotherapy worked better if you took the psychotherapist out of it, that people actually got better in a psychotherapeutic context if you just let them work it out themselves, take the authorities out of it. Mm-hmm. So when he got his hands on the mushroom and tried to do research at Harvard. He just applied his same the same discovery that he had made in the 50s, that this will work better if we take the institutions out of it, give it to the people. The risks were calculated. He knew there were going to be casualties. He knew the research community was going to react against him. But he was looking far into the future. And this was one of the beginnings of my presentation.
Yeah, and one of the things that happened in the future, of course, is the situation today is government science now. The scientists who work for the government, the environmental area and in medicine and science, and there's never been so much corruption as there is today. I was just thinking about George Riccardi's work on MDMA. Mm-hmm. It was at Stanford a few years ago. There's just one example. But since Bush, it's been an outrage the way government scientists are what government wants them to.
For those who don't know, maybe say something specifically about Riccardi's experiment.
Let me go even a little bit before George Riccardi, Michael, because I was involved in this. You know, I was a graduate student at the University of Chicago in the early 1980s, and I had begun to do MDMA research there, and I turned on this man named Charles Schuster, who was head of the University of Chicago Drug Abuse Research Unit. And he was very excited about this, and we began to talk about ways that we could use this to address cocaine addiction.
Right.
And then about 3 weeks later, this is now in May 1985, MDMA was suddenly declared illegal, an emergency ban on MDMA, and Charles Schuster was quoted in the newspaper as the national expert, that he had done studies showing on MDA and reason that that MDMA might cause brain damage. And I was furious, and I went right down to his office, and I said, how are you suddenly the national expert? You didn't even hear of this stuff, you know, a month ago.
Right.
And he was very, very apologetic. He took me into his office, and he said, look. And he kind of waved his hand at the full floor of the hospital, and he said, I have a really nice setup here. He said, the government gives us millions of dollars.
They pay for the conclusions, basically.
I have to do what they say. That's what he said to me. Yeah. I tell this story, you know, in my book that Ken mentioned on Timothy Leary, the memorial volume for Tim, in the interview with Andrew Weil, I tell this story.
Right.
And George Riccardi was Charles Schuster's protege. He worked in that laboratory. And this is where the whole serotonergic receptor brain damage myth began, that Riccardi, over the next 10 or 12 years, received millions of taxpayer dollars to perpetuate this myth.
Yes.
The experiments themselves, it was later shown, they were using methamphetamine instead of ecstasy.
And Riccardi was disgraced, though I wonder if he was fired from Stanford.
He'll probably be back again. I mean, Oliver North has his own TV show, so... Yeah.
Fired? Hell no. No, he's still doing it. I think he's at Johns Hopkins.
Right.
No, he's still the government's guy about MDMA.
You know, I remember Schuster at the MDMA conference and making these horrendous claims about MDMA. I think it was in San Francisco in the 1980s. And we all walked out. And I remember Tim was at that conference, but he was speaking. And he was like... smoking a joint in the, outside the auditorium, talking about what kind of crazy stuff was Schuster talking about. It's really interesting to hear your perspective on it, Bob.
Yeah, I will never forget that day. And I basically dropped out of graduate school 2 days after that. You know, he had a picture in his office of a bum slumped over in a gutter with graffiti on the wall behind him. And on the one side it said, God is love. And the other side of the bum, it said, fuck the world. And this kind of, because on the one hand, Schuster was so enthusiastic, you know, he wanted new drugs to find their therapeutic value. But his hands were tied. And one more thing, after he worked for the government and became their poster boy for MDMA, 2 years later, he was appointed to be the head of NIDA, head of the National Institute of Drug Abuse.
Yeah.
By the way,
that motto, God has left up the world. That could be the motto of the Bush administration, isn't it?
That sounds like, Grateful Dead and the Hell's Angels together or something, which has happened. Anyway, Where do you think it's all going? I mean, did you get an impression of where psychedelic culture is going and where psychedelic therapy is going? And were there discussions of the legitimate testing that's going on and all that?
Well, MAPS is funding a lot of research. There's much more research going on in Europe than there is, especially Germany and Switzerland, Spain, and Italy. More than there is here, but there is some going on here as well. I guess MAPS is kind of the backs a lot of these.
They have a handle on all of that.
MAPS. But it's very slow MAPS. and it really hasn't reached public consciousness yet.
Let me just underline that a little bit, Michael. The difference between the United States, the land of the free and the home of the brave, and European culture, because not only is there an incredible difference in the European openness and willingness and actual research projects underway at Franz Wohlenweider in Zurich particularly, but also all over the place in Europe, there's tremendous enthusiasm and things are getting done. But perhaps more importantly in Europe, you know, there's, for example, in Switzerland, there's nobody in jail in Switzerland for LSD or marijuana crimes.
Yeah.
And there are over a million people in jail in this country
That's the exact same thing.
This is an abomination of our freedom. Mm-hmm. And one thing that has always concerned me in the two decades that I've been involved in this field now is that the professional research community doesn't do enough to help these people that are in jail.
Well, I mean, they have this enormous prison industrial complex and drug enforcement complex, and it's all about the funding, apparently. I guess the Europeans.
Which we're trying to export to the rest of the world.
Well, we try to force
Canada,
it on
for
them,
example,
sure.
and Amsterdam, and there's, you know, but it's being resisted also.
Do you find that... Are people seeing the results of some of these experiments in Europe? I mean, I'm just imagining, you know, if a society becomes open to psychedelics, I mean, for instance, people say, I guess the news is somewhat ambivalent, but people say that Francis Crick realized or understood DNA while high on LSD. I know a number of people have written software programs on LSD. I wonder, in terms of being a tool for problem solving and so forth, that at some point we might actually start seeing like real tangible results. And people say, oh, over there in Europe where they're free to experiment, this is happening.
Well, this brings me back to Leary, because, you know, all this talk that about the opening of research and people are starting to do research here in the country. Timothy Leary, you know, made millions of researchers. Timothy Leary didn't stop psychedelic drug research. He turned it on.
Yeah.
And these results that you're talking about, Ken, we're already seeing them. You know, Crick is, of course, older. Crick was in the 50s, and I don't think that there's any ambivalence about that. I think that that's clear.
Well, I like to believe it.
Yeah, no, I think that is now on the record.
Yeah. He broke the DNA code under LSD.
Yes,
right.
Yes, that's right. And not so DNA. That's a pretty important discovery. But how about the kind of apocryphal story that Steve Jobs or Wozniak will neither confirm nor deny when asked how is it that these two guys working in their garage were able to come up with the personal computer before IBM with all their brains and money. And they said, well, we took more acid than they did. And if you read that wonderful new book, What the Dormouse Said, you will find other examples of of these breakthroughs in computer science attributed to the visions of psychedelic drugs.
Yeah,
and Timothy Leary said that the personal computer was the LSD of the 90s, and he was he talked about that.
I know, I love that line, and that's when Dick Price said that Tim Leary will be the first person to go and get computers made illegal.
You know, I always kind of disputed that whole story that Tim ruined research anyway, because, I mean, first of all, the Beats were interested in hallucinogens all the way back in the 1950s, and the Beats were you know, becoming popular. And second of all, I mean, in Leary's own biography, he talks about how this psychedelic surfer culture started coming up while he was still working in Harvard. And then, like, Ken Kesey probably, you know, did more to spread like the open use of psychedelics in some ways, or certainly more of the random use of psychedelics. And then, I mean, obviously the Beatles did more to, you know, spread, you know, and what is the guy? The guy's a prince now or whatever. You know, so, it's just sort of, it couldn't be helped. I mean, the culture was going to go that way anyway.
I can appreciate the perspective that that Tim was a little over the top, and he unnecessarily provoked a resistance. He enormously aggravated a problem that was easy to anticipate, as Huxley and Houston Smith and Frank Baron constantly tried to rein him in. And, sure. You know, I'm a father now, and I can imagine that if, you know, my son's going to go to college next year, and if there was some charismatic professor that was encouraging him to do something that I didn't understand, you know, I would be concerned. And
right.
So from that point of view, you know, there were people who heard Tim, and he's brilliant, handsome, you know, charismatic guy, you know, launching them into, you know, uncharted territory. That can be a little scary. So part of the resistance is, I think, I can understand that.
Yeah, I wouldn't want to minimize the force that he had. What was that quote that he had as he was leaving Harvard, that LSD causes panic in people who have never tried it?
Yeah, LSD causes psychotic reactions, yeah, or irrational behavior, yeah. Well, he was great with the one-liners, wasn't he?
Yeah. Well, any other final messages you want to leave to the Are You Serious listeners out there? What's better, LSD or ketamine?
LSD or what?
Ketamine.
Amphetamine?
Ketamine.
Ketamine. Which is better?
I didn't catch that.
What Ken is asking, what is better, LSD or ketamine? My answer is easy. I'm an LSD fan myself.
All right.
I
what
wish
about,
it were legal.
Ayahuasca or psilocybin?
I go for LSD.
How about ayahuasca versus psilocybin?
That's a tie to me. Those are
right. Well, we're gonna put up a top five for our listeners.
LSD goes to the top of the list.
Yeah.
I can't think of any list.
LSD is a perennial. It's an amazing substance that could be active in such a small amount, and I hope my listeners haven't been taking any LSD during this program, or they might become confused driving home, if they are driving home. Anyway, thanks a lot to both of you for coming by.
Thank you,
Ken. It's been a pleasure.
All right.
Many thanks to today's guests, Michael Horowitz and Robert Forty. The music you heard was Fences by Sync Synthetic. Join us again in 2 weeks when our guests will be erotica author and podcaster Violet Blue. The Are You Serious show is part of the Mondo Globo Network. Check out all the shows at mondoglobo.net. Thanks for listening, and don't be afraid of the dark.